poll asides the entire time. Both candidates should do it. And I would argue, and I think the facts would bear out, Donald Trump is doing a lot more of all of that than Kamala Harris is. And because she waited so long to try and engage voters and engage the media and talk through different outlets, that's why she's having to try to make up ground now, because she is slipping in the polls.
Now, Mark, she did do that interview with Fox this week that I know that, you know, Trump supporters found that say, oh, she didn't do well. Her supporters felt she walked into the lion's den and she fought back and she's on fire. And, you know, that's how they saw it very differently. But you know, everybody noticed that, including him. He noticed it. He brought it up at the Al Smith Center last night that she had done that interview. Does it bother him that she did that? I mean, because there's got to be a part of him that said, OK, the lion's den take on that, he would see it the same way.
I think he's happier with her responses that they're going to use in future ads. I think Aaron is right. What really is the thing that bothers him, or what you've mentioned that really bothers him, is the fact that he's being attacked for his energy levels in the campaign trail. I ran the numbers since October 1st, the beginning of the month, in 18 days. He's done 28 events in 26 cities spread across 12 states. And when Kamala Harris says that he's hiding from the public and the press, that just drives him crazy. And she knows what she's doing, and so far it does seem to be working. He's swinging at every pitch.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. Some of this is just about getting under someone's skin. So, Karen, I want to ask you about one of those many appearances that Trump did. Today was an interview that aired today with the former professional wrestler and media personality Tyrus, and I wanted to play one exchange that everyone is talking about. Here it is.
We need to see that fathers are capable of great things, because we've dealt with it, especially in the last 3.5 years,
right,
a complete dismemberment of what it is to be a man. We're under attack for everything.
We are. Actually, manhood is under attack.
Yeah.
I see things that are so beautiful, and the next day I see they're knocking the hell out of somebody for doing something that a day before I said, what a wonderful thing. Now we have to get back a little bit more.
Okay, Karen, I'll be honest. I don't really know what he was saying after the core point there, but he said manhood is under attack. Now, to be fair, that was in response to somebody who said a dismemberment of what it is to be a man, which let's just not take literally. But when he says manhood is under attack, is that effective with a certain group of voters? I mean, you know, you can say, okay, well, I didn't know Maxim made endorsements, the magazine, but they did come out and endorse Trump today.
Yeah, look, he believes that, and we saw this, you know, all the way back to 2016 when he would sort of, and frankly, years ago in the 80s, right, in New York, that was part of his swagger, right, that he was this kind of playboy. And that's kind of part of his definition of manhood. And that is something he has put forward time and time again. It's what that infamous, you know, you can grab him by the you know what was all about. At the same time, I think men are a lot smarter, most men, than Donald Trump. I should say the majority of American men. I think they're smart enough to know that he's a huckster and he's been trying to, you know, he's selling a shtick. They can either buy it or not. I think they're smart enough to know that the lives of their daughters and their sisters and their mothers, the women in their lives, are in danger by some of the, you know, by what Donald Trump would do. And I think they're smart enough to recognize that he is actually not going to be good for the bottom line, given that he's so into tariffs, which will increase inflation.
So, Mark, when Trump says, well, actually, manhood is under attack, you know, there are times that he does say things for hyperbole's sake or whatever, but it would actually seem this is one of those ones he actually means. I don't know. Is that what you understand it to be?
Yeah, that's a general belief in Republican and conservative circles. And that's a dividing line that we're seeing in this campaign, where there was a recent article in the Washington Post that accused the Trump campaign of being fueled by too much toxic masculinity. And the Trump campaign read that as essentially an attack on Trump for just standing up for men. This is one of these kind of men are from Mars and women are from Venus sort of campaigns that we're looking at.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to...
this is God. Whenever I'm in Pittsburgh, which is always because I'm omnipresent, I listen to every radio station at the same time, including WRCT.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you don't hear the phrase free market capitalism so much anymore, but the idea still tacitly undergirds much of what you do hear about why products and services are the way they are. We all know about corruption and cronyism, but we still accept that the company that wins, that corners the market, does so because people simply prefer what they sell. The anti-monopoly ruling against Google challenges that idea of how things work. We'll hear about it from Lee Heppner, senior legal counsel at the American Economic Liberties Project. Also on the show, a recent news report offered the familiar construction that the attacks of September 11th, 2001 plunged the U.S. into decades of war. Of course, that's not right. Choices were made, unpopular choices, about how to respond to the attacks. Choices were made to not bring assailants to trial for the crime, but instead to detain people without charge and hold them indefinitely in a prison designed to be outside U.S. law. None of it was inevitable. Now the defense secretary has stepped in to overturn plea agreements that, while they wouldn't have closed Guantanamo, would have brought some measure of closure to the cases against the alleged directors of the September 11th attacks. We'll get an update from Shaina Kadudal, senior managing attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. That's coming up, but first a quick look back at some recent press. With the presidential contest in full swing, the Sinclair Broadcast Group appears to be ramping up its right-wing propaganda again. While millions of Americans are subjected to the TV network's electioneering, few know it. That's because, as Pete Tucker details for Fair.org, Sinclair blends into the woodwork. So when you turn on your local news, you may well be watching a Sinclair station, even though on your screen it appears labeled as a major network, like CBS, NBC, or Fox. Millions of people tell pollsters they no longer trust the news media, but there's an exception. At least 6 years ago or so, 76% of Americans said they still trust their local news stations, more than the percentage professing to trust their family or friends, according to The New Yorker. Sinclair is smart enough to leave its affiliates alone long enough for them to develop a rapport with their audience. As former New York Times public editor Margaret Sullivan put it, the fact that it looks normal most of the time is part of the problem. What Sinclair is cynically doing is trading on the trust that develops among local news people and their local audience. By hijacking this relationship, Sinclair can sneak its propaganda into millions of homes, including in presidential swing states where the network owns more stations than any other. How do they do it? By requiring affiliates to air the right-wing stories it sends them. But because these segments are introduced or delivered by trusted local hosts, they gain credibility. Usually it goes undetected, but in 2018, Sinclair pushed its luck by requiring anchors around the country to read from the identical Trumpian anti-media script. A video compilation of dozens, if not hundreds, of Sinclair anchors voicing the same commentary went viral. Nevertheless, Tucker explains, Sinclair carries on largely under the radar, quietly gobbling up stations, mainly in cheaper markets. We're forever expanding, like the universe, said longtime leader David Smith, under whose watch the network has become the second largest in the country. Of the 294 TV stations that Sinclair owns or operates, at least 70 of them air the network's in-house national evening news broadcast. In January, Eugene Ramirez, who had anchored that broadcast for a year and a half, resigned. His public explanation was that every night he was given a list of four stories produced out of Sinclair's headquarters. From these, he had to select at least three to air. Often these stories were little more than write-ups of press releases from right-wing politicians and groups, like one from July whose headline read, "Trump PAC launches new ad hitting Democrats on border. Joe Biden does nothing." Sinclair frequently booked far-right guests to appear on Ramirez's broadcast, and he was instructed not to interrupt them, according to reporting by Popular Information. Ramirez was told that many Sinclair affiliates were not in big cities, and the content of the broadcast had to reflect the sensitivities of those viewers. Needless to say, progressive guests rarely, if ever, appeared. Popular Information also found that Sinclair requires around 200 of its affiliates to air its Question of the Day, which has included such gems as, "Do you think former House Speaker Pelosi deserves some of the blame for the January 6th riot?" Other questions were less obviously biased, but still betrayed tenets of independent journalism. As Tucker writes, it's one thing when a blowhard on Fox News asks, "Are you concerned violent criminals are crossing the border?" But it's quite another when the same question is asked by a familiar and trusted local anchor. And then remember that it's not just one local anchor, but a small army of them in communities across the country every day. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Google is a monopolist, and it has acted as one to maintain its monopoly. So ruled District Court Judge Ahmed Mehta in United States versus Google, being called a landmark antitrust case that will affect not just Google, but potentially all tech giants in the current landscape. The point was, Google pays billions every year to companies like Apple and Samsung that distribute search engines to ensure that it's the only search engine anyone would see, by making sure it's the preset default on devices. If your supermarket only had one brand of milk on the shelf, even if it had some others in the back, you would recognize that as unfair. But for many of us, the internet is still a mystery miracle, and we're not used to bringing the same sorts of questions to bear. If it did nothing else, this ruling changes that. So what happened? Lee Heppner is an antitrust lawyer and senior legal counsel for the American Economic Liberties Project. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Lee Heppner.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Sherman Antitrust Act sounds like a history lesson. It's from 1890, but it's living, meaningful law. How or why exactly did the judge determine that Google was in violation of it?
You said it right there. This is a law that dates back to the 19th century. It used to be used against railroad barons, has now been applied to this new tech industry. It's really proof of the durability of one of the foundational laws for ensuring fair markets and competition across our economy. And Google is ripe for being addressed by this law. The judge found that Google was essentially without competition in the market for search engines. And truth be told, I mean, 80% of overall searches are conducted via Google on mobile devices. That's 95%. And Google is able to profit extraordinarily off of not having competition and by blocking out rivals who threaten to create new and innovative products that actually benefit consumers and move this technology forward. So that was really at the crux of the judge's decision in this case.
So it isn't just that Google is the default search engine, it's that they are doing things, including paying money, to maintain that and to prevent other companies from being that.
That's exactly right. And the judge really eloquently, in his opinion, describes how Google maintains its power through that circular system. It pays for exclusive agreements across Apple, Samsung, Mozilla, other device manufacturers, and by virtue of those exclusive agreements, it achieves scale that it then sells to advertisers for extraordinary revenue, and then it reinvests that revenue back at the beginning in securing those exclusive agreements. So you really see how this is a self-reinforcing monopoly that Google has been able to maintain through anti-competitive conduct.
Well, and we know it's not by accident, if anyone were to believe that. There are internal messages I just read in a piece by Matt Stoller where Google is saying inertia is the path of least resistance. They know what they're doing.
Oh, absolutely. It's a clear monopoly strategy. And just to be clear, those are the communications that we were able to see. Google was also criticized by this judge for deleting untold number of records that were relevant to the litigation. And that was a big part of this case, too. What Google didn't say, because they were training employees to move communications to secret servers that auto-deleted chats. So even in the absence of a smoking gun, there was a very clear sense that Google was intentionally perpetuating an illegal scheme to maintain its market power.
Well, it's worth noting that this isn't just kind of a meta issue or inconsequential. There is an impact of the quality of searches. You know, not everyone's just looking for Thai restaurant near me. It matters if searches are not the best that they could be, yeah?
Yeah, we've all heard stories about Google search becoming worse over time. It's kind of harder to find that thing that you were looking for because they're not necessarily investing in the rank of search results, or they're prioritizing paid ads that look like organic search results. So Google has maintained its monopoly position, not necessarily by having a superior product, but by blocking out rivals. And that's just a core characteristic of monopolies that is as old as time, and we see across a lot of industries.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, Google is not being punished for building a better mousetrap. And news media, I think, play a role here for the anthropomorphizing of especially tech companies as scrappy, as game changers. They're not AT&T. We've sort of been trained to think these guys, and they are guys, break the rules, but on behalf of all of us. And that's not what's happening here.
Well, sure, and it's just a radically different industry than it was, say, in the early 2000s after we broke up the last big monopoly, Microsoft. That was a quarter century ago since the last decision that on a case brought by the government against a big monopoly. And then we were seeing that kind of scrappy innovation. Google was a startup at that point. And I think right there really lends to the potential of this case and of this decision to unlock a new era of innovation where small tech innovators are able to have a chance at entering the market and creating something new and cool that maybe we can't imagine today, but wouldn't be possible without breaking up Google's hold on this industry.
Well, I was going to ask you, what do you think happens now? We can't necessarily predict it, but in terms of the case, what do you think will happen as we look to the remedy stage of things?
Just to be clear, this is a case that was bifurcated. We just concluded the liability phase, and now the judge has to decide what to do about it. Mm-hmm. And what's good about this stage is that the court has broad latitude and must be deferential to the government's request for remedies after that really difficult finding of liability. And there's a lot of tools on the table. Certainly, we can expect an end to some of the exclusive agreements that have tied up this market for Google. But we also might see structural remedies that deprive Google of some of its ill-gotten gains and divest certain business lines or allow other search engines to have access to properties like Google's web indexer or even their large language model. The future of search is really in artificial intelligence and the ability of chatbots to really revolutionize how people get information off the internet. And so I think that we're going to be really clued in to how this court crafts remedies that ensure that that next era of AI innovation is not being controlled by Google or any other dominant player in this market.
Well, and then finally, do you see knock-on effects? It does seem like a paradigm shift in terms of antitrust and the way we think about big companies. Do you see knock-on effects on not just tech companies, but other big businesses?
I do. And I think that when you have a case of this magnitude, there is going to be a bit of a culture shift. So if I'm a big law firm advising my clients, I'm going to tell them, hey, if you are entering into these types of exclusive agreements that are intended to maintain your market power, maybe you shouldn't do that anymore, because the court is looking at these agreements with fresh eyes and they're not passing muster. I also think this decision builds momentum behind some of the other cases that the government has brought. There are parallels to the case against Live Nation, which also uses Ticketmaster to enter into exclusive agreements with venues. There are other parallels to the case against Apple or Amazon, which also kind of lock consumers into a single product ecosystem. So there's going to be knock-on effects outside of this case, outside of this industry, and also for other pending cases that we're watching closely.
All right, then we'll end on that note. We've been speaking with Lee Heppner, Senior Legal Counsel at the American Economic Liberties Project. They're online at economicliberties.us. Thank you so much, Lee Heppner, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Years of negotiations led to the recently announced pretrial agreements for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and two other defendants accused of directing the September 11, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. That would have meant their pleading guilty to charges including murder and conspiracy and receiving lifelong prison sentences. As AP put it, quote, "The torture that the defendants underwent while in CIA custody has slowed the cases and left the prospect of full trials and verdicts still uncertain, in part because of the inadmissibility of evidence linked to the torture," close quote. But at the 11th hour, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin stepped in to override the agreements, claiming to do so in the name of victims' families, the U.S. military, and the American public, who he says deserve the opportunity to see a military commission trial play out. Here to help us understand what happened and what happens now is Shaina Khadidal, Senior Managing Attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to Counterspin, Shaina Khadidal.
Thanks for having me.
Media attention to Guantanamo Bay and what happens to those held there has been spotty and in recent years largely absent. So listeners may have forgotten that men were held there for years without charge, much less conviction. Some have been approved for transfer, meaning they've been determined not to be a threat, yet have remained there. And of course, it's undisputed that many have been tortured and abused at this extra-legal military prison. So these plea agreements came with all of that context, all of that history. And they weren't seen as a victory for anyone. Those aren't the terms to think in. But they were seen as a meaningful and overdue step, yes?
Yeah, I think any plea bargain is a compromise, right? As CDB is described as kind of the least worst solution, given the history of these cases, right? And basically, they've been presented as trading off the death penalty in exchange for guilty pleas. But I think the thing listeners need to really know is that prosecutors, the military prosecutors, really badly wanted this deal done, because I think, like everyone else who is observing these cases, they recognize that the death penalty was never, as a practical matter, going to happen in these cases for a bunch of different reasons, right? First of all, the military commission system is incredibly slow. They've taken the most significant criminal trial of the century, the 9/11 case, and put it into a system where everything is being invented from scratch. So things that have been well established for two centuries in the federal criminal system have to be kind of reasoned out from the beginning in the military commissions. And then on top of that, there are these kind of issues around the use of torture evidence that have really slowed things down. That's not to say that torture evidence is the main problem standing in the way of a conviction. There is plenty of evidence against these particular defendants that isn't contaminated by torture, including interviews they did with media before they were ever captured. But the bottom line is that this process is going along really slowly. The defendants are in their mid-50s, the two older ones already. And then there are a bunch of other questions. Even if they got a guilty verdict, then there would be a sentencing phase where a military jury gets to decide between death and probably life imprisonment. And we know that the CIA is very reluctant to produce its own officials as witnesses in that kind of phase of proceedings. They basically refused to do it in another case that we had involving a plea bargain. So that may end up being something that stands in the way of a death penalty verdict. Then on top of that, there's a worry that military juries will do what some civilian juries have done and react to the torture at Guantanamo with clemency, that they'll want to punish the government by issuing a life sentence instead of death. So bottom line, the prosecutors really wanted this deal badly.
Well, that might surprise some folks, I think, on the face of it. And then kind of on the other hand, some people might imagine that any kind of plea deal would be opposed by the families and friends of those killed, the nearly 3,000 people killed on September 11th. But that wasn't really the case, was it?
Yeah, it's a very mixed bag, I must say, the family members. You know, there are a small group of family members who are very heavily engaged in the details of these cases, including the politics of it. And they fall all over the spectrum, just like regular Americans got 9/11 families with two full tomorrows who have been out there saying that they were strongly in favor of this deal because it offered some semblance of finality and because part of the deal, apparently, was the ability to pose questions, I believe in writing, to the defendants and have them answered within 45 days. And those questions would go to not just things like the motivations for carrying out the attacks, but also some detailed things that we don't have a lot of information about, even from their interrogations, things like the financing of the attacks, right? So the families wanted answers to these questions, and this was really the only way they were going to be able to get it. You know, on the other side, you've got folks who have been on Fox News a lot talking about how the conditions are much tougher than the civilian criminal system, which really, I think at this point in history, you can say is definitively not true, but have been kind of very actively organized in favor of keeping these cases in the military system. Right. I suppose it's probably worth noting that if these cases had been brought to the civilian system, they probably would have been over a long, long time ago. It's unfortunate that Eric Holder had made the decision in 2009 to bring these cases to New York and try them in front of a civilian jury. If that had been the case, as he said last week, these guys would have been a memory. The cases would have gone to trial in a year or two. The appeals would have been over in a year or two, and they probably would have received pretty severe sentences, maybe even death, and the cases would have been over. As Holder said, it was, quote-unquote, political hacks who stopped the cases from being brought to New York, where they would have been disposed of much more quickly than in the commissions. But again, that's sort of political water under the bridge. Congress has banned bringing men to the United States for trial from Guantanamo. So again, this is kind of the least worst solution, plea bargain in the military trial system.
Well, when people hear that Defense Secretary Austin revoked the pretrial agreements because there ought to be trials, I think a lot of people might be misled about what is meant by a trial in this situation, a military commission trial. What should we know about that?
Well, the first thing is that it's going to take years to get there. These charges originally were brought in February 2008, and so it's been, 15, 16 years of pretrial motions. And they're nowhere close to being done with that. Then once you get to a trial, there are going to be all sorts of issues about, again, the CIA producing witnesses to what they did to these men, not just in the merits phase, but also in the sentencing phase. And then also where it took place. Like, we have a lot of sensitive diplomatic kind of concerns around where the secret prisons the CIA held these men in were located, right? So that may stand in the way of actually conducting a trial. And after that, you've got appeals into a military appeal system, and then from there into the appellate courts in the federal system, and then to the Supreme Court. So, again, the oldest of these defendants is 56 years old. They are de facto already serving life sentences if you think that these cases are never going to come to a resolution after a trial and appeals. And so, again, it made perfect sense for the prosecutors to pursue this. The real question is kind of, what was Lloyd Austin thinking? He had to have been aware that these negotiations were underway and were pretty close to being resolved. The New York Times even reported over the weekend that DOD officials knew about the progress of the negotiations. So why the reversal? I mean, I think there's no explanation other than politics in the election.
That's what I was going to ask, because Austin says he's long believed that military trials were the only way forward. So that rings a little weird given the timing.
Well, when you see people like Tom Cotton coming out and saying that this is Biden being soft on the terrorists with the plea bargain deal, you can understand why it might have been everybody's preferred timing on the political end for this to happen after November. You know, but what comes next? Look, first, there'll be legal challenges. There are very narrow circumstances where a signed pretrial agreement like this, a plea bargain agreement, can be withdrawn. So I think the defendants are first probably going to challenge whether or not what Austin tried to do in voiding the agreements was even effective, whether he has power to void them. And on top of that, military prosecutors are supposed to be relatively independent from people above them in the chain of command. In the federal civilian criminal system, everybody knows that President Trump can remove the attorney general if he doesn't like some prosecution that he's undertaking, right? But there are some norms about how the AG is supposed to be relatively independent in making judgment calls, right? Well, on the military system, those aren't norms. They're actually written into the two major statutes, the Military Commissions Act and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So when you have civilian official like Lloyd Austin, political appointee, trying to pull the strings on a prosecutor's judgment, it's a serious problem. And dismissal of the case is the usual remedy for that. So again, something that could add years and years more delay to a system that wasn't exactly moving along quickly.
All right, then we'll end on that note. We've been speaking with Shaina Katidal, Senior Managing Attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. You can track their work on Guantanamo cases and others at ccrjustice.org. Shaina Katidal, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find years of shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to learn about FAIR's newsletter Extra and to show support for the show if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
Just is a real, I only know this.
Welcome to Ebony Spectrum here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
It's been a tradition for more than half a century that the major party candidates for president sit down with 60 Minutes in October. In 1968, it was Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey. This year, Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump accepted our invitation. But unfortunately, last week, Trump canceled. The campaign offered shifting explanations. First, it complained that we would fact-check the interview. We fact-check every story. Later, Trump said he needed an apology for his interview in 2020. Both campaigns understood this special would go ahead if either candidate backed out.
If he is not going to give your viewers the ability to have a meaningful, thoughtful conversation, question and answer with you, then watch his rallies. You're going to hear conversations that are about himself and all of his personal grievances. And what you will not hear is anything about you, the listener. You will not hear about how he's going to try to bring the country together, find common ground. A pre-Trump world, the 2024 presidential campaign would have been fundamentally reshaped in just the last 24 hours. Twice. First, an on-camera confession by the Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump, about his centrality in the January 6th insurrection, described as, quote, domestic terrorism by the Trump-appointed director of the FBI. And second, the most senior Republican official in Congress, the Republican Senate leader, caught on tape, his own recordings no less, describing his party's presidential nominee, Donald Trump, as a, quote, despicable person. And we should stop here and reiterate, in pre-Trump politics, each of these events alone is a race-changing blow. But we'll start with a damning on-camera confession of sorts from Donald Trump himself, the ex-president fielding questions from voters at a Univision town hall on Wednesday, including a question from a former Trump supporter. Here's the extraordinary exchange, almost in its entirety, so once again, you can reach your own conclusions about it.
I want to give you the opportunity to try to win back my vote. Okay. Your action and maybe inaction during your presidency and the last few years was a little disturbing to me. You know, what happened during January 6th and the fact that, you know, you waited so long to take action while your supporters were attacking the Capitol. Coronavirus, I thought the public was misled during coronavirus. And that many more lives could have been saved if we would have been informed better. And also people in your administration who don't support you. I'm curious how people so close to you and your administration no longer want to support you, so why would I want to support you? If you would answer these questions for me, I would really appreciate it and give you the opportunity. There's, you know, your own vice president doesn't want to support you now.
Thank you, Ramiro.
The people that don't support a very small portion, we have a tremendous, about 97% of the people in the administration support me. But because it's me, somebody doesn't support, they get a little publicity. The vice president, I disagree with him on what he did. I totally disagreed with him on what he did. Very importantly, you had hundreds of thousands of people come to Washington. They didn't come because of me. They came because of the election. They thought the election was a rigged election, and that's why they came. Some of those people went down to the Capitol. I said, peacefully and patriotically. Nothing done wrong at all. Nothing done wrong. And action was taken, strong action. Ashley Babbitt was killed. Nobody was killed. There were no guns down there. We didn't have guns. The others had guns, but we didn't have guns.
We didn't have guns. In case it wasn't clear, the we he is there referring to is the insurrectionists and him. The quote others that he refers to with guns are the police officers who defended the United States Capitol that day, and Mike Pence, and all the Republican members of the House and the Senate. So now, 19 days ago, Donald Trump is saying out loud what has been investigated through a congressional probe and the Department of Justice, a lot of that revealed in the body of evidence developed by those investigators, that the violent mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol was part of Trump's own plan to overturn his defeat on January 6th, and that mob was indeed armed. They did have guns. We had guns, Donald. And he knew that before he sent them to the Capitol. Here's Cassidy Hutchinson.
So, Ms. Hutchinson, is it your understanding that Mr. Ornato told the president about weapons at the rally on the morning of January 6th?
That's what Mr. Ornato relayed to me.
But when we were in the offstage announced tent, I was part of a conversation. I was in the vicinity of a conversation where I overheard the president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away.
It was a mystery for a while, right? How did he know that? They're not here to hurt me. Quote, let my people in. Now we know. We didn't have guns, he says. 19 days to Election Day, and Trump is telling voters the people who attacked the Capitol were part of a we. They were on his side, and he is on theirs still. It brings us to another stunning development today. A new book by Associated Press Washington Bureau Chief Michael Tackett reveals this, quote, Mitch McConnell said after the 2020 election that then-President Donald Trump was, quote, stupid, as well as being ill-tempered, a, quote, despicable human being, and a, quote, narcissist. And he said all that. That's when Mitch McConnell letter Donald Trump before the insurrection. More from the AP. Privately, McConnell said in his oral history that, quote, it's not just the Democrats who are counting the days until Trump left office, and that Trump's behavior only underscores the good judgment of the American people. They've had just enough of the misrepresentations, the outright lies, almost on a daily basis. And they fired him. And for a narcissist like him, McConnell continued, that's been really hard to take. And so his behavior since the election has been even worse by far than it was before, because he has no filter now at all. Now, before those Georgia runoffs, McConnell said Trump is, quote, stupid, as well as being ill-tempered and can't even figure out where his own best interests lie. Like we said, in a normal world, that would be a thunderclap, enough to completely derail a political campaign, a candidate leading a political party. So when we say that's not what it is anymore, this is an example that proves that out. An admission that you're on the side of the violent extremists who attacked the U.S. Capitol, and the number one Republican in the Senate calling you, quote, stupid, quote, despicable, and, quote, a narcissist. All that happened in the last 24 hours. Should be devastating, again, to a politician, someone seeking to run the government. But we live in a world where the GOP has splintered in two, rather violently. On one side, a robust authoritarian movement that demands you toss your views aside or become an outcast. People like Liz Cheney, Adam Kinzinger. Case in point, Mitch McConnell now supports the man he described in his own words in something called a personal oral history as stupid and despicable. His words on a tape recording he made and shared with a reporter. And on the other side, a small but growing group of disaffected Republicans and independent-minded voters. That split, particularly when it applies to January 6th and Donald Trump's disdain for the hallmarks of democracy, has given Vice President Kamala Harris an unprecedented opportunity and opening that she is seizing on with Republicans and independents.
Well, now, look who's coming to dinner.
Thank you, thank you. Good evening, rich people. I got to be honest. I feel like I'm at a casting call for Daddy Warbucks. And I'm not going to get the job. Welcome, Your Eminence, President Trump, First Lady, random millionaires who are not yet billionaires. Welcome to the 79th annual Al Smith Memorial Dinner. As you can, please give it up. Yes. As you can see how we're dressed, the theme again is let them eat cake. Now, I understand some of you may recognize me as the guy who plays Tim Walz on SNL. But I want you to know that I'm going to be fair and balanced tonight, and I'm going to make jokes about both Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't address the elephant in the room. You know, you're all thinking about it. Let me just cut to the point and point out who's not here. And of course, I'm talking about the middle class. That filthy group of people. Right, Chuck? Do you know what I'm talking about? Can we have a round of applause for Chuck Schumer? Right? See, he does like being near microphones. Now, but seriously, this is a special night, people. This is the one night when Republicans and Democrats who used to be Republican and Republicans who used to be Democrats and independents and whatever Michael Bloomberg is now, we can... There he is. He's up there. I love how the front row doesn't even look at me. You know what I mean? Like, do those seats cost more? How much does it cost to not have to look at Gaffigan? That's my Bloomberg impression. I don't know about you. I think this is exciting. This is very exciting, right? We are 19 days until the election and likely a civil war. And, you know, I'm nervous. You know what I mean? It's like, this is my first civil war, guys. I don't own a musket. Have we decided who's wearing blue and who's wearing gray? Because I look better in blue because of my eyes, you know? But, of course, let's acknowledge our host for the evening, the Archbishop of New York, Timothy Michael Cardinal Dolan. Timothy Michael Cardinal Dolan. You know, I tell you, as the father of five, saying that name feels like I'm trying to get my kids to come to dinner. Timothy Michael Cardinal Dinner. My wife and I, we do have three boys, and I hope our son, Cardinal, doesn't feel too much pressure to become a priest. Full disclosure, Cardinal Dolan is also a friend of mine, and I would never put him on the spot, but Cardinal Dolan, I'm curious. The Pope did say that this election is a choice between the lesser of two evils. And so, two-part question. One, do you agree? And two, who's more evil? All right, I'll come back to you. This, of course, is a Catholic event honoring Governor Al Smith, who in 1928 was the first Catholic to run on a major party. To put that in perspective, in 1928, Chuck Schumer was a first-term senator. Thanks for sitting here, Chuck. Of course, Joe Biden was our second Catholic president, right? After JFK, President Biden couldn't be here tonight. The DNC made sure of that. Oh, that's... I guess I'm the only one that reads history. But this is a Catholic event. I'm Catholic. Any Catholics here? Yeah. They're yelling because it's hard to clap when you're holding a cocktail. Right. You know, if I could, I'd like to talk about my faith for a moment. Personally, I am Catholic because I truly believe that's what my wife wants. In a way, she is my higher power and definitely a punishing God. Yeah. It's true. I was raised Catholic, but I am Catholic today because of my wife. And she didn't pressure me. She just said, this is what you believe now. And, you know, it wasn't like the Spanish Inquisition. There was an implied convert or die. My beautiful wife, Jeannie, is here with us tonight. She's not sitting on the dais. She's sitting out there with all those losers that are only millionaires. You know, it's like pull yourself up by your bootstraps, right, Chuck?
Right. Yeah.
Today is a special day. Today, my wife Jeannie and I are celebrating our 21st wedding anniversary. Thank you. Thank you. We're not. That's a lie. But being on a dais filled with politicians, journalists, and business people, I felt obligated to tell a lie. You know, I didn't want them to feel out of place. Besides, I don't know when our anniversary is. You know, this event has been referred to as the Catholic Met Gala. 22% of Americans identify as Catholic. Catholics will be a key demographic in every battleground state. I'm sorry, why is Vice President Harris not here? I mean, consider this. This is a room full of Catholics and Jews in New York City. This is a layup for the Democratic nominee. I mean, in her defense, I mean, she did find time to appear on The View, Howard Stern, Colbert, and the longtime staple of campaigning, the Call Her Daddy podcast. You know what I think it is? I think she doesn't like me. Chuck, do I have bad breath? You know, but I love New York City. I believe that this city is the greatest city on earth. I do believe that. I have lived here for 35 years. I'm raising my children here, which is not for everyone. Sometimes a friend from home will ask, like, why are you raising your children in New York City? And I always say the same thing, because I don't want them to end up like you. We've raised all five of our children in downtown Manhattan, and I can honestly tell you, it was a mistake. I don't know if you remember, but there was a time when you could walk a city block and not smell pot. You know? And don't get me wrong, I love driving an hour and a half to Randall's Island to watch my son play soccer for 20 minutes. Of course, New York City is where Donald Trump was raised, right? And he turned out great. Yet New York is a state that Donald Trump statistically has little chance to win. You know? Who says you can't go home again? Apparently, 20 million people. You know? We should not, but you know, let's not let this dais of dignitaries dressed like, you know, background actors on Downton Abbey distract from the significant achievement we've made tonight. I mean this in all sincerity. The money that we've raised tonight is significant and will have a positive impact, you know. And after we pressure Mike Bloomberg to give more money, We will break $10 million. $10 million. Everyone look at Michael Bloomberg and tell him he should give more money. $10 million is pretty impressive, you know what I mean? I mean, granted, it could get you a studio apartment in Manhattan, which seems, you know, expensive, especially considering you can get a mayor for two business class flights. Oh, I didn't think we had borders anymore. All right, let's go positive here. Can we have a round of applause for First Lady Melania Trump? Who presently has the number one book in America. Yeah. And you know, by the way, Jesus taught us to forgive seven times, not seven times, but 70 times seven. And Melania, you may be the first person to actually reach that. What's that? Oh, well, she surpassed it. Congratulations. You know, looking at this impressive dais of attendees up here, I never know how to address you people. Do you prefer, you know, global elite or coastal elite? You know, I mean, I know we live in sensitive times and I don't want to mislabel anyone. I'm personally excited to be up here, and not just because you make me look young and principled. You know, this seating arrangement is weird, right? I mean, it looks like the plutocrats are about to play Family Feud. And the survey says, whatever you want. This dais, actually, let's be honest, this entire room is filled with some of the most powerful people in New York City and Brian Kilmeade. Remember, Brian, I told you? Brian and I started doing stand-up together, so we're friends, hopefully. You know, because this room is, I'm glad you guys have a sense of humor about this, because this room is undeniably impressive. It really is. The prestige, the wealth, the allegations. I mean, wow. And don't feel bad if you don't have any allegations yet, okay? Which reminds me, Letitia James is here. She had a great year. She's just back there watching all of you. She's watching. By the way, can I point out that this is a very nimble thing that I'm trying to do, Brian? Because if I am too critical of Vice President Harris, I will, you know, I will lose friendships and, you know, and mess up my career. And if I am too critical of President Trump, I will lose friendships and improve my career. You know what I mean? We have an amazing, by the way, RFK Jr. is here. Welcome, sir. RFK Jr. He, of course, is going to make America, he's part of the MAGA, Make America Healthy Again. Right? I don't know if he's seen what Donald Trump eats, but Donald Trump eats like, well, me and the Cardinal, okay? And anyway, now the prompter guy, I went off book a little bit here. So anyway, I'd like to also welcome Mayor Adams, brought to you by Turkish Airlines. I was told to say that. It's a sponsorship deal, people. You know, we have a lot of formers on the dais tonight, all right? Former mayors, former governors, former respected journalists. is there any other kind, really? Now, I understand some people may have an issue with a journalist appearing on a dais hobnobbing with the rich and powerful. It would appear like a clear conflict of interest, and that's because it absolutely is. Look, the days of Walter Cronkite are gone. Most journalists have their own TikTok. You know, President Trump regularly appears on a show called Fox and Friends. That's not a mistake. He's their best friend. Former Mayor Bloomberg is here. Mayor Bloomberg, I want you're going to close that deal on bringing us to 10 million. Can you just not an agreement, sir? Okay. Now, by the way, there are rumors that Mayor Bloomberg is planning to run for mayor. I don't know if that's true. Quick question, Mayor Bloomberg. When you buy an election, do you put it on a credit card so you can get the points? Because that's what I would do. I already did the RFK joke, so. The one thing that I was going to say is that I feel like Donald Trump, make America healthy again. I feel like Donald Trump would probably be less loyal to RFK than he would be to KFC. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I think the rank of Colonel Sanders. Some of these I wrote during lunch. Woody Johnson is here tonight, owner of the New York Jets, heir to the Johnson & Johnson pharmaceutical fortune. You know, in divisive times, sir, you are a shining example, okay? If the head of Johnson & Johnson can sign an unvaxxed quarterback, maybe there is hope for this country. All right? Not only is Woody Johnson here, Robert Kraft, owner of the New England Patriots, is here. Welcome. By the way, as we know, they are bitter rivals on the football field. But here tonight, they're here for the same reason. Billionaires supporting Trump. It's really beautiful. We are 19 days from the election. This presidential election, it's been different, right? I mean, it's crazy because there's no Russian interference, no Facebook. It's crazy. It's being left up to American voters and four billionaires. The Cardinal wrote that joke. There is one group that baffles me, and I think it baffles most everyone in this country, and I'm talking about the undecided voter. Are you kidding me? I mean, are you kidding me? You don't know who you're voting for? You don't see a difference between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. Like, nobody has ever thought, wait, is that a Trump quote or a Harris quote? The media has begun discussing the phenomena of secret Trump voters. I don't know if you've heard about this. People who publicly say they would never vote for Trump, but then when they go in the voting booth, they do. It's a small group. They're called the Biden family. You know, I think we'd all agree that, you know, we live in divided times, and whoever is elected in November, I hope they establish an initiative to heal the divide that exists in this country. And I have a great name for this. It could be called Project 2025. It has a nice, Chuck, do you like it? Okay. Our first presentation tonight will be by Vice President Kamala Harris, okay? You have to admit, the Democrats have done an amazing job rebranding Vice President Harris, right? The term joyful warrior was used so many times at the Democratic convention, I felt like I was at a yoga retreat. Let's start off in a joyful warrior pose and then go straight into downward facing Doug Emhoff. Good, now laugh uncontrollably. Remember to breathe. Vice President Harris's trajectory has been astounding. In just the course of a couple months, she went from mediocre vice president to everyone's mamala. This is, of course, a historic race for many reasons, right? If Vice President Harris wins this election, not only would she be the first female president, a black woman would occupy the White House, a former Trump resident. Obviously, you wouldn't be renting to her. I mean, that would never happen anyway. Maybe if Doug did the signing. All right. That one didn't work. Yeah, this has been an interesting presidential campaign. The Democrats have been telling us Trump's re-election is a threat to democracy. In fact, they were so concerned of this threat, they staged a coup, ousted their democratically elected incumbent, and installed Kamala Harris. In other words, all her dreams have come true. Really? It really makes you consider the power of prayer, right, Cardinal? Sometimes prayers take 3.5 years and a George Clooney op-ed. Yeah. I don't know who's angry, but I don't care. But Vice President Harris did have a scheduling conflict, but was generous enough to send us this video. Let's take a look.
Your Eminence,